My name is Jody Kretzmann, and there are some other folks around here who will be leading us into a discussion tonight about a set of topics that are related to the celebration that's coming up in these days at Holden called Rainbow on the Mountaintop. We're talking tonight about multicultural living, some of the challenges in multicultural work and life, and also a lot of the joys that I suspect, all in this room have experienced at some point or other. And what I'd really like for us to do is to have the major part of the hour together be sharing those stories, both about challenges and about the joys of working in multicultural kinds of settings, because certainly that kind of work carries both of them. Let me say a word about Rainbow on the Mountaintop at Holden, since most of you will be around, at least during the beginning of that, as we get into it this week. The official beginning is Wednesday. Rainbow is one effort in really an ongoing 30-year conversation here at Holden about one of the major difficulties involved in this beautiful setting, and that is that it is off the beaten path for most people in the world, right? And that unless you are sort of part of the path, particularly the well-worn path that runs from Minneapolis to here, right? And that is mostly trod upon by Scandinavians, right? If you are not part of that particular path, it's very difficult to know about Holden, to feel invited here, to feel about this place, that it can be your place. So Holden's been committed over the years, I think, to be not only aware of, but to be working on the question of how this place, this wonderful corner of God's creation, can in fact belong to all of the people of God's creation. And that work, as we all know in our daily lives in the United States, has to be intentional, thought-out work. It's not something that just happens if you wish it to happen. That's not true about multicultural life in the United States. It's intentional and it needs to be worked at if it's going to work at all. So this is the fourth summer of one aspect. This is just one little aspect of Holden's commitment to sort of broadening the community that feels this place is all of ours. This is the fourth summer of a kind of concentrated effort where really the themes of the week and a lot of the teaching of the weeks and some more guests during the weeks and some more staff people during the weeks come up and provide this place with a few more of the colors of the rainbow than normally find their way up. And the Holden's hope about this celebration of Rainbow on the Mountaintop is that it increasingly becomes a 52-week-a-year event. It's still, though, I think terrifically important to highlight multicultural themes, the rainbow themes, for some short period during the year to allow people to sort of see that there's a flag up here, there's something visible, right, that people can look at and say, aha, that looks like it might be interesting, that looks like it might be a safe place to be, that looks like it's going to be a welcoming place to be. So I think that's part of what Holden is attempting to do in these days that come. And I hope that and trust that these will be days of celebration and joy and some struggle as we work on these questions. Just a word about the context for the discussion tonight. I think that these are hard times for people who care about and work on racial justice. I think that we better be aware of this, all of the indicators in the United States say that blacks and whites, to take one set of examples, have grown farther apart in this last decade than we have been for decades. That economically, the split has widened between blacks and whites. Residentially, the split has widened between blacks and whites. And I might say the same thing is true of other racial groups in the United States and ethnic groups in the United States. That rather than, in fact, becoming a closer and more multiculturally interwoven kind of fabric in the United States, we have been becoming, over the last 15 years, a more separated culture. But at the same time, I think, the numbers of people in African American, in Asian, in Native American, in Hispanic, and in European communities throughout the United States, the number of people who are increasingly committed to working on this set of agendas as a central part of who it is to be a United States citizen. That number of people has also, I'm convinced, been growing. Right? So you've got this paradox of an increased number of people, I think, committed to interracial justice, interracial living in a variety of ways, and all of the indicators that say that's getting harder and harder and that things are getting, in fact, worse. This is the sort of paradox of the moment, it seems to me, at this time. We're at a time when the church, at least the ELCA, those of us who have some relationships with that particular denomination, and some others nationally, have made some new kinds of commitments in terms of resources and personnel and leadership training to living out their vision of what it means to be God's people of the rainbow. And it seems to me that lots of people in the United States are beginning to come to grips with the reality that we are now, in fact, a nation that is about one quarter people of color, non-European peoples, and that percentage of peoples will continue to go up in the United States. And I think the last thing I would say contextually is that I think there are more and more people who understand that our usual way of thinking about race in the United States is exactly backwards. That is, that really for the last 20 years, at least at the national level, people have thought about race in the United States as a set of problems to be solved. New immigrants from Southeast Asia or from Latin America are more problems to be solved. They raise issues and borders and of work that we all have to work on. They are basically a pain in the butt, right? It seems to me that if one of the interesting things that happens if you travel around the world, certainly Europe, but particularly in the third world, people are absolutely still fascinated by the experiment in the United States, that's trying to create a democratic fabric woven of all of the peoples of the world. If you talk to folks about what's interesting to them about the United States, that's what's interesting. That's what there is to celebrate. We in the United States, and I think in the Reagan administration, have really, and perhaps the one that has followed, have really lost our ability to think about all of the colors of the rainbow who are present in our culture as a set of capacities, as a set of strengths to celebrate. That's the way the rest of the world thinks about us when they think about us positively. And it seems to me that a place like Holden and the church, when the church is real to the gospel call, is about living out that kind of image of God's creation. So that's the context of the conversation tonight. I've asked a couple of people who, I'm sure there are lots of people here who are experienced in multicultural work, whose lives have led you into a variety of encounters, people from other backgrounds, and you've experienced both the challenges and the joys of that. I've asked a couple of people to begin with just a story or two or a reflection or two on either the joys and or the challenges, or both, and then we'll just open it up and see whether we can collect a series of vignettes that help us think about where we are. Is that following me here? Okay. Fred Rajan from Chicago, in the church-wide headquarters of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Fred is one of the persons I asked. I sometimes ask Fred to do something and he doesn't do it. I don't know whether tonight will be one of those nights.
Jody, when you are sharing about, when you are giving the introduction, I was sitting here thinking what I wanted to say. And to me, probably the best place to begin and also to look at some of the joys and also the challenges is to speak in terms of what the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is trying to attempt to address the issues which you have touched on, because that is where my expertise is and also much of my interest is in. as some of you may know, that back in 1987, at the Constituting Assembly of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, which I will call, in short, ELCA, he set a goal, that is, within 10 years of his existence, at least 10% of his membership will be at least 10% African-American, Asian, Hispanic, and Native American. The interesting thing about the thing is, no other denomination, either it is Roman Catholic or Protestant denomination, ever set a goal like that, an intentional effort. None of the denominations have ever made attempts. Of course, other denominations have much more higher percentage of African-American, Asian, Hispanic, and Native Americans than the Lutherans have, but Lutheran denomination of the ELCA is one of the major denominations ever set a goal like that. Number two, when it set the goal, it's also very mindful of the challenge it is in front of the church. Number one, at the time, the church membership is declining. The church was looking for its own identity in the U.S. and the Caribbean. And number three is even the membership of African American, Asian, Hispanic, and Native American in the church was very low, less than 2% of the total ELCA membership is African American, Asian, Hispanic, and Native American. So these are some of the challenges it saw. But at the same time, it wanted to be faithful to the gospel and also very mindful of the fact that we are called to do ministry in the U.S. and Caribbean, where more than 21% of the population is African American, Asian, Hispanic, and Native American. So if we had to be faithful to the gospel and the place God has placed on this church, then we had to take it as a challenge. The church has taken this as a challenge. But that when with the challenge you take, it's also there are a lot of obstacles on the way. Number one, we are not prepared for this. We do not think multiculturally. We see multiculturalism as a special interest. You know, anytime you talk about multicultural issues, at least a majority of the people who are sitting in the room, they think, it's a little core group of people, what we call radicals, who like to change the church. That's what they are trying to do. Rather than looking at a great potential for this church is right there. And number two, when we start thinking about multicultural church, we try to think in terms of pigeonholing. We are trying to put people in certain categories rather than to say we are all called by God to faithful witnesses for the gospel. We forget that. And these are some of the challenges underneath the issues the church faces. Out of all this, the joy we could see even in the ELCA experience has been, ever since ELCA came into existence, that is 88 and 89, the total membership of the church continued to decline. The decline is also pretty steady decline, serious decline in membership. But the only place where we are seeing some growth in membership is the ethnic membership growth. In 88, we had around 13,000 new members who were added, and most of the people in that category were adult baptism, that is, people who came to the Lutheran Church from other denominations or from or unchurched folks. In 1989, the same thing. We have received around 8,000 new people. Again, the majority of the people came through adult baptism or transferred from other denominations. So that has been a very healthy sign for the church. So even though there are a lot of painful things we go through, the joy is to say that there is some hopeful signs we see in the church. So I will quit here and then we'll proceed further.
Okay, thank you, Fred. Furlan?
Well, let me start off by saying one of my pet peeves is the word minority. I never liked that word, and it was used first in relation to blacks, but after it really began to hit home during the Reagan administration, that basically now everybody who's not a white male is a minority, you know, which doesn't make any sense at all to me. Now everybody's a minority. So, it just bothered me. But then on the flip side, the reality is that that makes us all in this together. You know, so nobody is exempt if everybody's a minority. So that's something that has occurred to me. And also my work in Washington, D.C., working with homeless people and realizing that homelessness knows no race or gender. And I saw in D.C., most of the homeless men are black, but you know, you still have 20% homeless men who are white, and plenty of homeless children, many colors, who are. And so on that note, it made me realize that it's a realization that we're kind of all in this together. No problem that we have in this country is just a black problem or just a Hispanic problem or whatever. That the problems we have in this country are all, you know, everybody's problem. I'm supposed to end on a high note, right?
there's no musical direction here, Merlot. Any note at all is fine.
Give me a little time, I'll get to it.
Okay, thanks. You want to take a break before getting to it? All right. I was just assuming that everybody knew Verlon Brown. Pastor Verlon Brown is the new pastor of Holden Village, and he's sort of stepping into that role as we speak. And we're all terrifically glad to have him here for the next while at Holden. Also asked a couple other people to think about this question to kick it off. Ingrid Christensen has done work in Chicago, which is a multicultural city par excellence, for the last 20 years in multicultural settings. Ingrid, what are you thinking about?
I guess I just wanted to say that I teach in an urban studies program that Jody founded. I'm currently the director of it, which has about 14 people on our staff and about 75 students every semester. And we are committed in our program to being multicultural, both in the staff and in the students and in the subjects that we teach, because we are about the city of Chicago. And the city of Chicago is extremely segregated, but also very multicultural. It's not easy for all of us on our staff. We're about one-third people of color. We're about half women and half men. We struggle with it all the time. We've been struggling with it for 21 years now. You'd think we'd grow up or learn or something, but it's not something you can just decide to do and do. And I think the most patience on our staff is called for on the part of the people of color who have enough respect for and faith in the fact that we are committed together to do this, to work on these issues, that they continue to patiently say, that's a racist idea, and this is why, and teach us, and we receive those gifts with gratitude, and sometimes with resentment. But it's not easy. It's a really rich, wonderful project to be engaged in. And I think all of us on our staff are committed to it, but it's not something that I would just like to say, I'm okay, that's behind me, I'm done with that now. I know I'm up to speed on it, I'm hip, but it's not so easy. One of the sets of rewards, there are sort of two main areas where real rewards come in our work, because we're in this struggle with each other all the time and working on it. One is with our students. We get college students from 15 or so private liberal arts colleges around the Midwest, St. Olaf and Carleton and McAllister and Lake Forest and Grinnell and Cornell, that sort of bunch of schools. All those schools have about 4% people of color in their student body. Some of them are down to 1 or 2%. The students who come in our program come in greater numbers, so maybe we're 10 or 12% students of color on the program in any given semester. We see those students' needs getting met in our program by having our staff conscious of the issues, working on the issues, and we see them flowering as human beings. We see a place where their issues are taken seriously, where their humanity is taken seriously, reward us by their growth, by the white students as well as the students of color, by incredible change and development, and it just seems like it's got to be good, that work and that struggle. Some of the ways that works itself out is that students who come who have never had, just African-American students, say, or Asian-American students, who have never had teachers who look like them, or at least not in college, and often never, and they come to us and they get them. And the difference that makes in their life in terms of role models and making them imagine the kinds of things they can do with their life is terrific. It's tremendous. It makes such a difference that there's just no measuring it. It's an incredible change. And the fact that we teach about issues from the point of view of people of color a lot, as though that's regular, not as though it's an exception or we'll take one day on that and then 3 or 4 days looking at the same issue from a white perspective or something. But we really work at assuming that all issues are multicultural in Chicago, and they all are, of course. Race is the bottom line on practically everything around. The students begin to have self-respect, they change in their attitude about their vocation, they change in their attitude about what's possible in the world, and it's work that clearly pays off. So that's a wonderful way in which we see that we're on the right track in some sense. The other way we do is that our program has been in the city for many years. We have 21 years worth of alumni around the city, so maybe 150 students a year, many of whom decide to stay in Chicago. We're credible in the city. We are a place where leadership in Chicago, people who are African American, Native American, Asian American, Hispanic American, can come together and dialogue in front of us, for our students, with us. They can work with our faculty. We have common projects that we take on. We're a place in the city where we have some trust and some respect. And that doesn't come easy, especially in a city that's as racist as Chicago. So we see that we do some kind of good for the city in that way, and that the stuff we do research on and think about and talk about and teach our students is are all issues that are at the core of the life of the city, and it's a place where there's some free space for people to talk to each other. Part of our model involves having speakers a lot for our students, and we can get people who are fighting in the newspapers with each other from different communities to come and sit down with us and talk with us and with each other without having to posture and fight and have roles assigned to them, but in fact can really communicate with each other. We, for example, Harold Washington was on our board of directors long before he was mayor of the city of Chicago, and was someone that we frequently had come and talk to our students. And it was a wonderful support for Harold then when he started running for mayor, because I think we figured out 1/3 of the white workers in his campaign the first time around were urban studies program students, alums, or faculty. And so there's a lot of people. And then some of the real advisors that he had were people from our faculty. Jody's one of them, and also several of our black faculty. So it feels like the right thing to be doing intellectually. To me, it looks like the right thing to be doing. But what I have to say to you is that it's not easy. We struggle. We have our staff meeting once a week on Thursdays. We sit from about 1 to 4:30. We work on a consensus model, and we struggle through issues. And we talk about race in an upfront way. Of course, me from Moorhead, Minnesota, took me a while to get used to that, because there we say, oh, everyone's alike under the skin. But You have to start acknowledging differences and then deal with them, and I think it's really a good project to be doing.
Okay, thank you. I know that a couple other people in this room have had some really intense experiences over the years, and I've asked Al and Sarah if you want to, is there anything you want to talk about in terms of your Al and Sarah Pitcher, who are resident folks here at Holden, who have spent much of their life on in Chicago also, doing work first in the civil rights movement, and then in community development work in the south side of Chicago. Anything strike you, any stories? Or you're doing an Alphonse and Gaston back here.
Well, I, for some unknown reason, had three or four different phases of my relation to African Americans. The first phase was what I call, if you're going to integrate, you integrate. What we do is expect the black community or the African American community to integrate into the white community. So I began in 1937 to go into a black community, south side of Chicago, and I used to put a big horn on the top of my car and go down and harangue with mobs and try to organize the unemployed.
1937 this was, Al?
1937. Woo! I had a little group that met once a week, so I'd go into their homes once a week, and we had our little groups, and we'd have our big meetings, and I suspect there were more than three white people ever at any meeting during that whole period. In the 40s, I went to Buffalo, and I, for some unknown reason, volunteered to take a young adult group in a UCC-affiliated dead congregational church, and I sponsored the African-American youth group, young adult group. So again, I spent a couple of nights, one with the planning group and another with the actual meetings. And then in the 50s, I was haranguing people in the Church Federation meeting about all this, and I decided, well, again, so every other Sunday I went to a black church on the south side of Chicago. I said, if you're going to integrate, you got to integrate. That was my line. That we think about this integration the wrong way. So then every other Sunday for a while, I went to William Johnson's church in 48th in Michigan. And Bill Johnson, of course, has been a friend of mine ever since. But at any rate, it was a very interesting experience. You had the equivalent of the Rockefeller Memorial Chapel Choir, and then you had the Gospel Choir. You had two whole different services. And you had a community meeting with about 2.5 hours. But it was a great, great experience. Then in the 60s, I got involved with Selma and March on Washington and a group that were trying to get black officials in Chicago elected. And for some unknown reason, I was elected chaplain of this. There were, I think, two white people and 26 African-Americans on the board, and I was elected the chaplain. And, you know, these are all kind of unbelievable stories and kind of miracles in my existence. So I sat around with them for a couple of years, and then school boycotts, the school superintendent was a racist, and I got somehow involved with that, and involved with the Chicago Freedom Movement, and became the administrative assistant to the director of the Chicago Freedom Movement. That was a kind of integrated group for two or three years. We invited King to come to Chicago, so Sarah and I were really doing a lot of logistical work for King's visit. And for another unknown reason, I got to be a part of the core of that decision-making group, and that was an experience. And then it flopped, we failed, and King left, and all that was left was Jesse Jackson, Fred Baskin, now Bush. so we became part of his staff, of Jesse's staff. So Sarah's brother for 7 years, and Sarah was there a couple of years. I was there 5 years. Again, we were what you call, you may not like minority, but I know what it's like to be a minority, because that's what I was. And I remember once when some of the staff accused me of plotting to kill them, and we held a kangaroo court in St. Joe's Hospital where Jesse was. And, that's the kind of experience that you really have to go through in order to understand. And of course, I was never quite as important again. Even though there was no truth at all to it, it meant that my role was somewhat cut down. But nevertheless, I went on until about 71. Then the next stage was of my involvement was at University Church, the Disciple UCC-affiliated church, where we took in a black church. That's the way that church became integrated. We had a few token African-Americans, but we took in 30 or 35 members, all of whom were our equals in education, experience, status, or more. So that all of a sudden became a different kind of a church. But I got us to have what I called a caucus. It was a caucus in which we worked on the problem of getting integration to be real and mean something. And it was a terrific experience. I mean, we have such deep, strong, human, affectional relations with all kinds of people who are in that church, and I'm on leave right now from there. Well, in the midst of that, this story goes on, I'm sorry. We were up here and we decided we should move in the direction of community, so we founded an intentional Christian community. And the only place we could get property, some of us would have probably moved that direction anyway, but the only place we'd get property was just on the border of the university community. In an African-American community, 98% African-American. So that's where we've been living since 1979, in an integrated, intentional Christian community. And if I'm not wrong, of the people living in the building now, 24 are African-American, and about 26 are, no, 20 are African-American, and about 30 are, one Filipino, and the rest of us are kind of ordinary. we have nothing special about us to be attractive. Mine run. Anyway, that's gone on now for 10 years. And we're frequently accused of being racist. It's the most difficult. At one point, they called me the Antichrist and picketed our church on Easter, called us plantation owners. And while the thrust of it was from white leadership, it was chiefly an African-American group that was the bulk of the organized opposition to our existence as a intentional Christian community. So that's been very interesting, and that's gone on, and you get all kinds of alternations between being called a racist and being called the only place that I feel I have a family at all by the same person, it's fairly interesting. Well, as a part of this operation, we started a development corporation in Woodlawn, this community in which we live, and for a while I was the executive director, and then we switched roles as a black woman, and I was the associate, and the people accused me of being the forefront of the university, of the ex-teacher at the university. They thought I was the university's lead in gentrifying their community and driving out most of the people by virtue of the rise in property values. So that you face a real difficulty. So I would say that for 30 years or so, I've been almost alone sometimes in a black environment. And you notice so much. If you go to a wedding or a funeral, you are alone as a white person. There may be two or three who, for one reason or another, but the separation is so, so vivid in terms of living and in terms of very crucial events like the church life and the funerals and things like that. The separation is unbelievably stark. And so that's kind of the history of my existence. And for a couple of years in the 80s, I went back and worked for Jesse again and some stuff. And again, I was a minority, practically the only person in the whole Bush organization was white. So it's been rich. I think I know more African-Americans and have closer relations in some ways, more supportive relations from them than I have from white Americans, or whatever you call us, pink Americans. But it causes you to wonder how you overcome the separations among people. That it seems that something deep in our natures needs to find a basis for separating ourselves from whole groups of people. And it can be religion, or it can be race, or it can be strange things, but we somehow seem to need that. It's really a tough job to represent in your being, particularly if you try to institutionalize it, some other way of looking at people.
Thank you. Let me say two brief things and then just open it up for some people to join the conversation at this point about Al, what you've just shared in terms of your rich story. I hope that, I mean, I don't know too many other people, too many other white folks from whom I have learned as much as from you, Al, off and on over 20 years, about the dynamics of working in very tough interracial situations. And I hope that, I'm glad that you did the whole 55 years. And I hope people feel free to intersect with Al during the coming week and 10 days and delve into some of this rich stuff here more deeply, because I don't know of too many white folks who've been where you've been over the last 55 years. And glad to have you part of the conversation. The other just theme to lift up, Al, I think out of your talk and some of the other comments here, is that we're clearly not dealing just with color. We have to be dealing with color and power at the same time, right? And that and because we're dealing always with the dimension of power, skin color always has with it an added invitation to suspicion, right? So that there's no way for me just to be a white individual dealing with non-white individuals or people of color. I'm always a representative of the white culture. And therefore, from my point of view, I have to work at understanding why there's always going to be suspicion about anybody who's white who's working in multicultural settings. And I think there are probably other ways in which people who are Asian American, African American, have to work out the different ways that power intersects with relationships when we're working multiculturally. Let me just open it up now. Other people who have stories to share, challenges, joys, leap in. Or stick your toe in briefly.
I found myself in a situation in Chicago. I was working on the west side in a private school. And it was an all-black organization, and I was one of four white teachers. And I felt taken advantage of in my situation. The people that were running my situation, I think knew that I was out to save the world. I was very naive in my intentions, and I hadn't taught before. In fact, I didn't have a degree. It was a private school. And I was only able to stay with that position for about 6 months because it was so difficult for me. And I felt that I was very much of an outsider and I was not welcomed. I was not really given any chance. I mean, I was a dead bird the first day I went in there. And I, you know, looking back, I keep thinking, how could I have made it a better situation? Could I have loved the kids more? No, I couldn't have. I did the best job that I could have done. But I kept getting stomped on by the administration. And I'm wondering, was I a threat of some type? You know, did maybe the people think that I thought that I could go in and change the world? You know, or I haven't resolved these kind of things. And I'm really struggling because I still live in Chicago and I'm still looking for that service that I can do because I too would love to see more of the culture come back together, but it is segregated by street. And so I'm real confused with, you know, how I as Joe Citizen can help pull things together more, whether it's at work or, you know, just at home, at church, whatever.
Any responses? Any advice?
Well,
for long?
I think a lot of white people just don't understand or take for granted just how much black people distrust white people. I think there's a certain, I think the bottom line of it all is that white people think they're better than black people, and black people dislike you for that. No, it's logical to think you're better. You get better food, you wear better clothes, you better travel, you get a better education. If you don't think about it enough, you know, you think, well, my God, I am better, you know. But I don't think you can ever go into a situation. I mean, just what you said, you didn't have a degree, but you were teaching, mm-hmm. you know. How many black people don't have a degree and are teaching anywhere? You know, get to go in a private school and teach, you know.
I mean, in my situation, just for the record, none of them had their degrees, so I kind of was in that same boat with them.
Okay.
For that particular situation.
But you can never, you know, you can never underestimate how much you're distrusted by people of color. You know, just like I can never underestimate I never underestimate how much most whites think they're better than I am. I'm not sure if the word is shocked or surprised, but I guess it never surprises me when somewhere down the line it comes out that somebody assumes that my check is bad, or you know, I'm not, my education, my degree isn't as good as somebody else. You know, just little bitty things like that. I guess I would say never underestimate that, which, you know, Jesus talks about being as shrewd as serpents, but as gentle as lambs. You know, it's that kind of a thing. You know, never underestimate that, but at the same time, you know, be willing to work through it.
Is the man here who I talked to this afternoon who helped Malefe? I guess not. A couple of years ago, we had an African, South African man here for Rainbow on the Mountaintop, and he rode out in the boat and with a lot of other people from Holden and got offered a ride toward Seattle, and they wanted to stop for the night, and they couldn't find a motel that would accept all three of them.
That was Dumasani?
No, it wasn't Dumasani. It was Malefe. And, I'm not sure who it was, I don't remember. anyhow, they went to 10 different hotels, motels, looking for a white couple and a black man, looking for rooms to rent, and couldn't find. And they ended up spending 2 days together because this couple was so incredibly shocked at how this man that they'd been taught by a beholden and had really become fond of couldn't find room in the inn. They ended up going to some little town outside Seattle.
One of the things we've discovered at Rainbow over the last few years is that a lot of the African-American guests who've been up to Rainbow have stories to tell about their travels here. Just encounter after encounter in lodging places, in eating places. A group from a church in Detroit 2 summers ago was having a picnic in Chelan, and they told by then a really hilarious story, but I'm sure it was frightening when it happened, of the, a lot of townspeople at Chelan beginning to sort of gather around and just sort of gape at this group of picnickers, right? And a couple of the people from the Detroit parish were just absolutely outgoing and gutsy women, and they just went over and started introducing themselves and invited them in for food. So it turned out to be a joyous time, but that's not exactly what was going on at the beginning of all that. It was a sort of tense situation.
Well, and included among the gapers were some police.
Yeah. You know. Yeah.
Jody, I think that points to some things about the title that you put up there, Multicultural Life and Work. That for many white people in our nation, despite the fact that it's a nation that's filled with a great deal of variety, cultural variety, racial variety, we don't confront that unless we choose to. And we can choose when and where we're willing to do that. And so when I think about what experiences have I had that would be relevant to this discussion, the thing that I realize is they're all experiences that I chose. You know, that when I lived in Chicago, I took the L, you know. That I worked in a shelter, you know. It's things that I chose to do. And that's not something necessarily I think that makes me, that I should be so proud of, but something that I need to realize that for me it's a luxury to think about having a life and work that is influenced by the multicultural reality. I can either take that in or not, or I can decide, well, for my entertainment, I really like jazz and blues, so, you know, then I'll do something that's multicultural, but for other parts of my life, I won't. So I guess, for me, I think that's really important to always remember that for everyone, it's not a choice. And that affects my experience as well.
Yeah. Probably adding on to that thing of people of color have to almost, you should all have degrees in sociology because you lived your life, your culture, but you have to know the other culture, you have to kind of understand the other culture to be able to move around in the white culture. And when you're from Minneapolis, it's really necessary. Because the black community is not as large as in other metropolitan areas. So you're, in a sense, it's like it's your responsibility as a person of color to kind of educate everybody else, people that are not of color, and that's it should be the other way around. I think that kind of adds what Al was saying. Mm-hmm. Majority community, a community with power, in a sense, it's a part of their responsibility to understand what our
We see that all the time in our teaching. I think that virtually all of our African American students are bicultural by necessity. They know both something of their own culture and a lot about European derived cultures. And virtually none of our white students are absolutely isolated.
Yeah, Lowell?
Well, about a year and a half ago, I got a job, I live in Baltimore. I got a job with a very small consulting firm. It was a minority-owned firm, minority-owned company. Two women ran it, two black women, all other workers, everybody in the building was two companies, were all black, I was the only white person. I wasn't out to save the world, I just needed a job. And one of the interesting things was that I think that my coworkers and I were sort of joined together pretty quickly because women who ran the company were kind of crazy. And we were, you know, the workers saying, well, what is it with these women? So we were all sort of brought together pretty quickly, but and we were just all there doing the job. I guess I must sort of like being a token. I mean, I come here and I'm a non-Christian coming to a Christian community, and I was sort of, I wasn't hired as a token in this company, I just happened to be the only white person. But I was very, very quickly accepted and treated very well. I mean, we talked a lot about obviously difference. I mean, we didn't try to ignore that I was white and everybody else was black. It was really, it was a very, very good experience. Everybody was extremely warm to me. I'm close friends with two of them I work with now. But after about, I worked there for a year, and after about 6 months, one of my coworkers said, you know, you ought to get your master's degree, and then you could teach at Morgan State, which is almost entirely black college in Baltimore. And somebody else said, yeah, that'd be a good idea. It'd be a good thing for you to do, and you're already used to black people. And I said, well, you make me sound like a lion tamer. But they said, well, you know what we mean. And I did sort of know, you know. I mean, these were not my first black friends. I mean, I do live in Baltimore, which is a largely black city. But most of my friends are white, you know. And but it was just, I guess I didn't feel awkward being there. And I guess that was what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Why did they think you should get your master's degree, and why didn't they think they should?
Well, we were just discussing, I mean, we were always boosting each other. Mm. You know, you ought to get into computers, you're so darn good at this, you ought to get better training. And we were just constantly telling each other, you know, that sort of thing. That just happened to be their plan for me, that I would make a good teacher. Mm.
Why did you leave?
Actually, virtually every worker in the company left within about 2 months of each other after a year. Why? Because the women who ran the company really were kind of crazy.
That can happen any place, I suspect, with any gender, with any race. Right.
One of the best experiences I ever had was going to Europe. My wife's is Danish and proud of it. And we went to Europe based under the auspices of visiting her family. But we spent 6 weeks roaming around Europe and being with her family in Copenhagen and Zurich, but one of the things that really hit me is that I was treated better in Europe than I've ever been treated in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I felt safer in Europe than I ever felt in the U.S. Her family was as open to me as any, more so than any family that I've dealt with in the U.S. And it amazes me how a culture that doesn't have a history of enslavement of my people, anyway, how that affects, you know, things. But ever since I've been back, I've been telling people in my family and everybody that I feel it's more, for the first time after being in Europe and coming back, I felt more like an American in Europe than I ever felt here in the U.S.
Huh.
And I felt like what Europe did for me was made me feel like I was a citizen of the world and not just trapped in this fishbowl in the U.S. where I was at the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. And I've told people since, any black person that would listen, that if I had it to do all over again, I'd go to Europe first before I went to college. Because that experience gives you something that education will never give you, that money will never give you if you stay in the U.S. And that's a feeling that nobody is out to get you. I mean, that the whole world doesn't hate you, that the whole world isn't out to belittle you. You know, it's just here. It's just here in the U.S. where you have to put up with that sort of thing. And that the racial problem towards black people anyway has been institutionalized so in the U.S. that even individuals, and I've lived with, not since 1937, but I've lived primarily among whites for almost 20 years now. And, you know, I make the transition back and forth. You know, I say, you guys, and then when I go home, I say, y'all. But it gave me, you know, this rainbow on the mountaintop thing. To me, it's a call to see yourselves, to see ourselves as citizens of the world, and not just trapped in this muddle here in the U.S. because we spend so much time caught up in this racial mess here in the U.S. that we forget that, you know, in another country, we're Americans, you know. And I think I ran into white Americans who were complaining about Europe. And part of the reason they were complaining because they were no longer the favorite sons and daughters, you know. So that was a realization for them. And I've been to Canada, you know, pretty much throughout Canada. And to me, it's not a vacation until I can step off of American soil. And, you know, that's when I feel like, you know, an American. It's a relief, you know, it's just a burden gone. Because I got a whole history of those traveling stories. Mm. I could tell you where, you know, you end up in a small town and you go in someplace to eat and they kind of stare at you and the mothers have to pull the children away because they're staring at you and you don't know if they spit in the food or, you know, or what, you know, just those kind of things.
Sure. It's interesting to think, Berlan, about the whole history, obviously, of African-American leadership who had that experience from Du Bois to Paul Robeson to James Baldwin and for so many black leaders throughout the century. In fact, a trip to Europe was somehow formative and reformative of their idea of the United States.
There's a whole history of black people who have left the country and never came back.
Yes.
You can't buy the book anywhere, but if you go in the library and you look deep enough, there are several books written, and I can't remember the name, of people. After every war, black people have left the country and never come back. So it's not a new thing, you know, it's not a bizarre thing, but it's happened to quite a few.
Right.
Yes.
So it's really interesting what you bring up, Ron, and maybe even Netter can help me out with what I'm going to say, but I grew up in Kansas City, and from what all I could tell there, the racial tension was quite muffled, and I never really sensed any racial problems in that area. It wasn't until I went to Denmark that I was faced with racial problems, and there were two. I was in Denmark for 8 months, and there were two distinct periods. The first half, I was in Copenhagen and living with a Danish family and very much incorporated with the Danish family there. And they were always talking bad about the Northern Africans and the Middle Easterns and the Sri Lankans, mm-hmm. Who had been coming up there recently because of the turmoil in those areas, in those countries. And not so much with the blacks. And they were always, when I would go out or I'd be in a social setting with Danish people, pushing around those people, physically pushing them around in bars or wherever it may be. And then the second part, I was in a folk school way out in the country, and the students there was a guy from Iran who had escaped and a guy from Sri Lanka who had escaped the civil war there. And I got to sit down and talk with them about the problems. And I got to go out with them to the bars and to be with them when they got pushed around. And it was like a really eye-opening experience. And it wasn't until I had gotten to be with them that I really saw an injustice being done to a person or a representative of a race of people. And it really got me thinking because, like I say, and Verlon, I don't know, because you live in Kansas City for a while, and I don't know, in Kansas City, it really seems to be in the back burner of racial problems, at least for me. And it wasn't until I went to Denmark that I saw racial problems. It wasn't so much against blacks.
You want to respond, Verlon? It's probably not too unusual for white folks in the United States not to be aware of racial problems.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, Kansas City is pretty split racially, right?
Most of my horror stories are from Kansas City.
That's right.
since I grew up there, and I think the racial stuff is very much on the back burner. Just a quick little story. We were going to have our class reunion, our 10-year class reunion, and I went to an integrated high school, and the whites wanted to have it at a country club that didn't allow blacks. So you go to an integrated high school, and then you got to have your class reunion in two different places because the blacks wanted to have it at a certain place, the whites wanted to have it at this country club. So, you know.